Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. My name is John.
Hi, I'm JP.
And this week we are on chapter 2 of The Pragmatic Programmer, from Journeyman to Master. Chapter 1 was awesome, and we're going to be blowing through many of the tips covered in chapter 2. However, we won't be covering all of them, as we went a little long in our recording last time, so we're going to be doing 5 tips per episode as we're walking through this book, and there's just some great tips and content to dig into, so I'm super excited to get started.
Cool. And so just to let you guys know, this chapter is titled A Pragmatic Approach. And so all of these tips are going to be centered around the idea of how can I approach software problems pragmatically? Like, what would a pragmatic programmer do? And so, yeah. So, John, what are the 5 tips? And then after we review what these 5 tips are, we'll go a little more in depth in them.
But I'm a little lost here. Am I missing one?
Oh, no. So we're going to cover 4 today, and then next week we're going to be covering 5.
Awesome. Cool. So the 4 tips that we're going to be reviewing today is 1, don't repeat yourself. 2, make it easy to reuse. 3, eliminate effects between unrelated things. And 4, use tracer bullets to find the target. So those are the 4 tips, and let's first jump into don't repeat yourself. So we've all heard this in programming, especially in the Ruby community. As a Rails guy, I feel like dry is like one of the main mantras. Dry, don't repeat yourself. And you know, duplicated code arises in a lot of different ways, and the book starts to talk through these different ways that they happen. You kind of want to walk us through those ways that happens, JP?
Yeah, so wet code or dry code can happen 4 different ways. It's imposed, meaning like as a developer, you feel like you have no choice. 2, it's inadvertent. You don't mean to duplicate the code. You don't even realize you're doing it. 3, you're impatient. And this one cuts me deep.
You get
lazy and you duplicate code because it seems easier. And 4, you might be working with another developer on a bigger team and you might duplicate code that you didn't know existed. And so it's like, it's actually kind of inadvertent. Like, you don't realize that you're duplicating other people's code.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the main one that happens, at least for me, is the impatient. Like, I will be writing something and it's like, oh, I've kind of done this, but you just start writing it. You get the test passing, you just kind of get it written, and then you don't go back and refactor and make it a shared method. Or even I realized halfway through making something that, oh, this is very much a shared behavior that I could be writing once.
Yeah, and I think what you just said right there even jumps the gun a little bit, because when I get impatient, sometimes it's like, I don't want to write a test. And it's like, fuck it, I'm just going to ship this thing. And so like you end up not writing a test and you just end up repeating code because you're just like, I just want to get this thing. You're like, you're impatient. Like, I don't want to do this, which is something that's kind of hard to admit. Like, you don't want to admit that as a developer, but hey, it happens.
Yeah. It's funny because just today, actually, I have this project that has this, it has a requirement for a custom emoji picker. So it's like they want to easily surface 6 emojis for this text field. And there's like 6 different text. Well, actually, there's 4 different text field types across the project. And all 4 different text field types have this same emoji picker rewritten in the JavaScript for no reason at all. It could be a single JavaScript file that I pull in. But like, because I didn't bother to make it a repeatable piece of code, it's shared across the project. So even today I'm admitting this, but I will have that cleaned up by next time we talk. I promise that, JP.
Yeah. So, I mean, this first one is like pretty simple, but I feel like for the sake of completeness, you kind of have to hear it. But yeah, it's just don't repeat yourself. And if you find yourself repeating yourself, maybe take a step back and reevaluate, because when you don't repeat yourself, it kind of goes back to the other tip we had discussed about like care about your craft. And so like really care about like the work that you're doing.
Yeah. And when we mean repeat ourselves, just for those, if you're a more junior dev, is like actually like writing a method again and again, that's maybe slightly different, and you could be implementing that same method across multiple places. Mm-hmm. So let's say you have 2 different user models and you're calling user.firstname and you're not inheriting from each other. You're not sharing that code in ways. So it's intelligently using code that doesn't step on other things, which we'll actually get to in a further tip.
Yeah. And that's a kind of a nice segue into the second one, tip number 12 in total of the whole book. So tip 12 is make it easy to reuse. And so this sort of goes with the idea of dry, in the sense that like you want your code to be able to be easily reused, and you can avoid having your code not be dry by having your code easy to reuse. Like, okay, so that sounds like a lot of theory, but for example, imagine you're writing an algorithm and you realize that parts of this algorithm are like repeating the same steps. And so you might have this really long like method definition or function definition. And it's like, huh, I'm doing the same thing here and I'm doing the same thing here. Like, instead of like duplicating that, just tease that out, abstract that into its own function. And then now guess what? You can test that function itself. And then your code, your like main algorithm is going to be a lot easier to test itself because you don't have to like go through the steps of repeating all those same different steps.
Yeah.
This tip number 12 brought up this concept of orthogonality, being like orthogonal. And so basically what that is in the world of programming is that basically like two concepts can move independently of each other. So basically like the idea of like decoupling things is sort of what people mean when you hear the word orthogonal. For example, like your database, like all of the like code in your database is going to be orthogonal to like your UI. Like if you change something in your database, it shouldn't affect your UI, kind of a thing, right?
Yeah. Or this is putting things like too much business logic or business logic in the view or in a controller where it should be maybe on the model level. It's making even models too interdependent of each other. We talked about this a lot when we were covering a domain-driven design, which is, you know, having things kind of being in their own space without touching too many other things and have too many interdependencies. It can get really messy really quick.
Yeah. Actually, there was a really funny metaphor about like to visualize this idea of orthogonality. Orthogonality, that's a funny word. And it's basically, imagine being like a helicopter pilot, or imagine sitting in the seat, the passenger seat of a helicopter, and the helicopter pilot, for whatever reason, like passes out, and all of a sudden you have to take the wheel. But like, you know, steering and navigating a helicopter is not just easy. It's not like driving a car where you just like put your foot on the pedals and like hit the gas and hit the brakes. Like, you know, it's kind of like you steer things, but like this mechanism might not be, it's like tied with another mechanism. So you don't just like put your foot on the gas, you know, all these like gadgets and like those steering wheels, not like your average steering wheel. So that's kind of like a not orthogonal system where things are super, super independent of each other. And I think an easier example to maybe visualize is like driving stick shift. Like a stick shift car is not orthogonal, whereas like an automatic car is, because you can like, you don't have to shift gears. Your car just does that for you. So you can just like hit the gas and hit the brake whenever you want. Like there's no idea of a clutch. Whereas like driving in a manual car, the idea of a clutch makes the whole system itself not orthogonal.
Yeah, absolutely. Like everything, for example, in the helicopter controls, every control affects another. And to have one action, you need three or more controls. So it's like you just want to take a right turn, but that actually takes the foot pedals and the joystick in a helicopter. You can't just like move the joystick. You'll just kind of wiggle back and forth. I remember like the first time I flew a drone, the way like one stick is vertical speed and rotation and the other is like the angle. And it's like super weird to get your head around if you've ever done something like that. But I think it's like the idea and the metaphor carries over in that if you want to accomplish a specific task within one model of your application, you shouldn't have to be dependent on others. Mm-hmm. Like if you want to make a quote right turn with one model in your application, you shouldn't have to be pulling in all these crazy dependencies and running methods from other places. It should just be super clean to be able to make that code kind of independent to itself. And that leads us right into tip 13. So tip 12 was make it easy to reuse. Tip 13 is eliminate effects between unrelated things. Cool. And so it's a very similar concept, and these concepts really flow into each other really well, because this one here is making sure that each component is self-contained. And you put a note here, JP, which is like, that's very much the case for React components. And you could speak to that more, I'm sure. And for me, I totally get that that's within Ruby methods as well. Like, we want to make sure that we're not too tightly knit, especially like across models in an application.
Yeah. And so the reason I say that is because when I first started testing React components, I was like, this is hell. Like, testing JavaScript sucks. Testing UI sucks. Like, how come like testing, like, why is this so painful? And this was like the same feeling of pain that I felt when I first started like learning Minitest for Ruby, like, I don't know, a year and a half ago. And I remember I had this really long method. It might've been like 15, 20 lines or something like that. And then you see the examples on these docs and they're like, oh, it's just easy. Like, you just assert that this, and then your method should be fully tested. It's like off this one assertion. And I was like, this is absolutely bonkers. Like, my method is so long. Like, what do you mean? Like, how am I supposed to test this? And I had like all these side effects going on. Like, in retrospect, if I really wanted to test that method, I'd have to have mocks, I'd have to have stubs, I'd have to like expect certain things about those mocks. But like, in reality, when I like learned how to test better, and, you know, not repeating yourself and only having like single responsibility so that your methods only do one thing so that they're easier to test. Then I realized like in Ruby land, I was like, oh, testing is actually pretty cool. And then I had that same like aha moment for like testing React components because, you know, I was doing a lot of things where I was like managing state and I was managing the UI and I was managing like all these different things in my components. But then I realized like I should just have like a container component that manages like the API call. And then I should just have like other dump components that just that we send them data, like given some data, they output some UI. And once I realized that I could have these like components be like more self-contained and like unrelated to each other, then it was like a lot easier to test because I could just test them like simple functions.
Yeah. I think if testing is that painful and that difficult, it's probably that the code maybe isn't written very elegantly.
Yeah.
Or even that the domain isn't very elegantly thought through, you know, and that could be a sign that you just haven't like designed the system enough and you probably have to have some more objects that interact with each other. Because when you're totally right, like in times when I was first learning testing, it was so hard and it was so difficult. And it's like, oh, it's because I had really shitty code that was had so many dependencies. Yeah, absolutely. So I couldn't agree more with that. So let's talk through some ways that this orthogonality can be applied to different types of work. And you know, he walked through in this book, he walked through some of these things just about how much your efficiency can be increased if one team can work on something and solve those problems interdependent from affecting other systems in too deep of ways. You know, if you have a system that's too interdependent, you end up really stepping on each other's toes. If you have multiple coders in there, it can be really difficult. And really, it goes back to, in a lot of ways, what we've talked through in domain-driven design, which is having a eloquent model and nouns and those nouns broken out in a way that doesn't affect other things and it doesn't step on other pieces.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I actually have a little blunder and there is a tip 14, but I think somewhere in the typing of Markdown, it got lost. But I love that these tips like literally just flow right into each other. It's a nice little flow. And so what tip 14 is, so we actually are going to be covering five tips this time and then four tips in the second half of chapter two. But tip number 14 is there are no final decisions, which I thought was a very interesting concept because what it's saying is that you shouldn't think of the components that make up your app to be like set in stone. So like when you're making an app, let's say that you decide for whatever reason you want to go with Mongo as like your choice of database. That's not to say that like a year down the line, that's like, that's it. We can only use Mongo and we're locked into Mongo or whatever. Or let's say you choose Devise for whatever reason and you're a Rails developer and you want to use Devise as like your system of authentication. That's not to say that like a year down the line that you can't just like rip it out because you don't want it anymore. Like, so you have to be careful with like the toolkits and the things that you use because you should ideally, in an ideal world, design your code so that like if I don't want to use Mongo anymore, good thing we have this like nice abstracted code so that if we don't want to use it anymore, we could like successfully rip it out and tease it out and then implement a new database design. That's not to say that it's going to be like super easy where I could just like take Mongo out, drop Postgres in and, you know, run a migration and all of a sudden like everything's hunky-dory. I mean, it's not going to be that easy, obviously, but it shouldn't be like a super, super painful thing where like you are absolutely 100% locked in where you have to do it that way without like doing a complete code rewrite.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. He actually talked through this concept of reversibility and that you should be able to reverse decisions and you shouldn't feel like decisions are so permanent and so important that they have to be done a specific way. And if it does feel that way, then you're probably thinking about your code in the wrong ways or designing it in a way that isn't supple. I'll borrow that word from our last book. You know, and you're not thinking about it in a way that is reversible and you can just switch out, you know, Mandrill when Mandrill shut down over to SendGrid easily to just switch out that email system because you're not using it in a way that's abstracted, like you're too close to the metal on that API. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because actually one of the founders that I work with, we were talking about just kind of casually replacing Stripe for our payout systems with a different payout system just to like save on our percentages. And I like thought about it for a second and I was like, this actually like wouldn't be that difficult because I have this object that manages this payouts for these, you know, it's like a platform workers. It's like we have that object there. It wouldn't be that difficult to just switch out that logic that's just sending that payout to a different service. There was some other business reasons why we didn't decide to make that switch, but I was like excited to think through that the implementation wouldn't be that difficult. And this is reversible. And I think it's really important to make sure that you can do that and don't let everything feel like it's the final decision or the only way to build something out.
Totally. Yeah, I love this quote. It's, instead of carving decisions in stone, think of them more as being written in the sand at the beach. A big wave can come along and wipe them out at any time. And that's like so true. Like you shouldn't be like tied to one technology. Hell, maybe it's like React one day, but like maybe your view layer is like so abstracted and so modularized that like you can like change it to Vue at some point. I don't know. But like speaking from like Ruby land or like Rails land, this is like why I really love using like the adapter pattern. And so the concept of like the adapter pattern is a classic like design pattern, whatever, is that like you can plug and play different things. And so like typically if I'm making like external API calls in a Rails application, like let's say, for example, it's like Twilio or like, let's say, no, I don't like, I use Twilio way too much in examples in these podcasts. So let's say it's Google Maps. How about that? And so like if I'm making external API calls to the Google Maps API in order for me to get like geo coordinates, for example, I'm not going to like stick that into a Google Maps controller because like that feels so set in stone. Like that does not seem adaptable at all. I can't just like all of a sudden if I want to use like some other third party API, like, I don't know, Bing Maps, for example, or like Ask Jeeves Maps, I have to like rewrite the name of that controller. So what I like to do is I like to have like a folder for like adapters. And so like adapters, and I like to like generally like name these a lot more general. So instead of saying like Google Maps controller, it might just be geo coordinates adapter. And so like that is so general and so not specific to anything. Geo coordinates can literally be like any third party API. Like you, like as a viewer of that code later on, you don't see geo coordinates adapter and think like, oh, that's going to be calling the Google Maps API. Like that could be calling anything. So it's nice to be able to just like have these interfaces that are more general purpose so that when you do want to like swap things out, you do have that ability to like reverse the decisions that you've made in the past, which I think is kind of cool.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And even the service, you know, the whole services concept can be wrapped in a similar way. You know, I know that I've built things out. It's like payment method service, things like that to handle Stripe calls. And I like it too, because it helps you start thinking about the language of your domain more and not designing to the design of the API that you're building against. So it's like more of expressing your domain with that API instead of like forcing the way the API is doing something onto your business that you're trying to do. So I really like that adapter model or service model. It's a really good approach for something like that. And it does allow that reversibility, not only for external services, but for different types of method calls. Like we've talked about the idea of a notification service. And I just worked on a project recently where it only had SMS and in-app notifications, and we just spun out all email notifications. And it wasn't that hard because I already had this global notification service. It was just augmenting that existing service.
Yeah, and I like what you had mentioned just right now about like it being reflective of your domain, because now all of a sudden you're using words that are coming from your domain. And if you haven't listened to our previous season of this podcast, we talked a lot about like having a ubiquitous language and being able to communicate the right verbs and nouns and terminology to your team. And so imagine like being able to communicate in like in plain English to someone who is not perhaps technical. You know, someone might not know what the heck Twilio is. And if you say like, oh yeah, what we're going to do is we're going to refactor the Twilio controller, they're going to be like, what the fuck is a Twilio controller? But if you were like, hey, we're going to make changes to the notification service, like that is just so explicit. And they don't have to know the implementation details. Like they don't need to know that you're using Twilio and that you're switching from Twilio to, I don't know, Xerxes or something. They can just know that it's part of the notification module of your domain.
Yeah, absolutely. That said, I want to jump into tip 15. This is actually one of my favorites. On top of all the stuff that was really great, which I do love that idea of reversible decisions. It's like, don't feel like everything's so final and try to build things that you can make it reversible. Mm-hmm. But this last tip that we're going to be reviewing is use tracer bullets to find the target. And I just absolutely love this example. It's a practice that I really try to do, but I really like the way it break it down here. So let's jump into it. So he says, when you're firing a machine gun in the dark, you can either calculate everything and make a precise shot. So know the wind speed, know exactly where your target's going to be, know exactly the round that you're firing, the angles that you need to fire it, and then fire it. Because in the dark, you can't see it necessarily. Or the second option is just use tracer bullets, which tracer bullets are these ammunition. You see it in movies, and I always thought it was like fake, but no, mm-hmm. This is like in World War II, we had this. I remember my grandpa telling me about it in World War II. But they basically are every 10 shots or so in a machine gun, it's a round that glows bright red as it fires toward the target. So literally you fire and as you're firing, you're seeing these tracer bullets go out toward your target and you see whether or not they hit. And so it's literally just the idea of like having a little bit of a visual signal to where you're going, but you're actually shooting bullets and you're getting them out there. So it's a very much like a fire aim kind of a concept. And this could like sound a little scary, especially coming from our context of domain-driven design, which is like be thoughtful in how you approach something. The concept here isn't just be sloppy and write terrible code and like just build scaffold something out. The overall concept here is to create what you're trying to build. So let's say you have a change or a feature, you're trying to spec something out. Build it as simple as possible using real code and real interface, but maybe it's only 10% of the feature set. Maybe it's less. So it's not about degraded quality. It's not about sloppy code. It's not about fake code. It's not just about like putting buttons on the screen that you're just kind of navigating with HTML and CSS. It's about building the feature, but at its very, very basics to validate it. So it's a lot like an MVP or a mockup, but it's real code that has testing that's built with thought in mind, but it's very, very simple. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, totally. The one thing that I will say though is that it's not to be confused with a prototype. So everything you said is 100%, but the authors don't want you to think of this tracer code as a prototype, because when you think of prototype, that sort of connotes this idea of like it's disposable. So like when I create a prototype, it might just be like you said, static pages that looks like it's going to fool the user. Like I'm going to have buttons that don't actually do anything, that don't actually make API calls. I'm just going to navigate to some other page. So that's a different kind of MVP where you prototype things out. But the difference is that you write prototype code knowing that you're going to throw it away. You're never going to use it again. Whereas tracer code is more like the bare bones. It's like you're setting the foundation, you're writing the skeleton for what the actual code is going to be. It's not to say like you said, like don't write shitty code and whatever. It's like literally just tease it out, like write a little bit at a time and see if it lands, like see if it hits. And the thing is like you approach prototypes with the intention or knowing that you're going to throw it away, but you approach tracer code with the intention that it's going to be built upon. Like you might throw it away, but you might not. Like that's the hope is not to, or the hope is to like build upon it and refactor it. But yeah, that's like really the only thing I'd have to add on to that. But yeah, totally. That's totally it.
Yeah. In a way, I imagine tracer code is like, imagine you want to build a house. You know, you can sit down with a pen and paper and just kind of start mocking up blueprints and start drafting. That to me is prototyping. This is just a draft. It's kind of drafting, maybe drawing in the sand where the house could go, but you're not actually building a real house. Where tracer code is you build a full real foundation and you build full walls, but you know what? You don't maybe put the drywall on. Or you don't put the electrical in the walls, but you have a real foundation to come back to make sure that it's really flushed out. And a good example is I have a client right now who wants to augment their platform with an event scheduling system. So they want the ability to, the spec given to me was, we want the ability to create events that have descriptions, attached links, maybe even addresses for a real world place to meet up. And then we want this whole ability to comment on events, have attendance, whether or not they're going. We want a roster of who's going to go. And then after it's done, we want to confirm who showed up at the event or not. And it's like this whole big feature set that's almost like Facebook events in a way where people can, you know, I am going, I'm planning on going type of a thing for an event. And the first thing I said is, I love this idea. Let's just build the idea of an event with a date and a description. So it's a real feature. It's going to have full testing and we're building it, but it's really tracer code. And I approached this with that intent that we're going to go back and we're going to do more here. But in a lot of ways, it's kind of boiling the rocks like we talked about in the last episode, which is this idea of like doing what you can now, but it's not a prototype, which is what I really like. I'm not throwing a bunch of shitty code that I'm hoping you know, with to-do comments in it that I'm hoping to refactor one day. No, we're building really great quality code, but it's really simple features to test this out, to test the waters, and to start to build a foundation for where we're going to go. And I love this concept. And it reminds me, too, of Basecamp's approach that I mentioned on our last call, which was the idea that they won't compromise code quality and they won't extend a ship date. They will just reduce the amount of features that they're putting in. And I think that that is essentially what tracer code is, just less features.
I was literally just about to reference that. I think that was like tip 10, which is like, I think it was like push for quality or something like that. So like, you don't ever want to compromise on your quality. Just, you know, narrow the feature set. Don't like ship something that's like shitty.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's exactly what tracer code is. I think that's awesome. And it's a nice segue into the difference between like tracer code and prototypes. However, we will be touching on prototypes in the next episode.
Yep. And I'm excited to talk about that. So that is it actually for chapter 2, the first half of those 5 tips we were able to blow through. I hope you guys are getting as much out of this book as we are. We're super excited to continue to power through this one, and it's awesome stuff here. So you want to jump into picks, JP?
Yeah. So my pick, you know, I don't know if I've picked this before, but it has to be. And if I have picked it before, screw it. It's such a great pick. It's it's the testing library that I've been using for React, and it's called React Testing Library. In fact, I think I have picked this before, but F it. It's by Kent Dodds, and it is a really, really great way to test your React. And if you couple it with Jest and React Testing Library is like my dream come true. There's like no configuration, no setup. It's kind of like how Minitest is like baked into Rails. You have Jest baked into like Create React App, so it's like you can just start bootstrapping and testing immediately. And previously, you know, sometimes testing is hard because not just like actually writing tests and getting your tests to like run, but like actually setting up your tests. I remember trying to set up tests for React, like with Enzyme, you have to have like an adapter for the version of React that you're using, and you have to like make all these setup files, and you have to change this and that. And it's like, shit, I mean, I'm having like this struggle before I even wrote my first test. Like I can't even get my tests to like compile. But with React Testing Library, you literally just yarn install that sucker and like you're good to go. It's like awesome. And like the API itself for it is just like super simple, and it makes it really easy to test the way that your users interact with your UI, which is what you want to be testing and not testing implementation details. And so yeah, that's my pick. What's yours?
Awesome. Good pick. I don't think you've picked that one in the past, just FYI. Mine is non-technical, but incredibly helpful if you are a freelance developer. It is a service called Calendly, calendly.com. It has saved me hours and hours and hours of work. Basically, what it is this. You sign in with your Google account, and I am a heavy user of Google Calendar. It looks at your existing calendar, and so it knows when you could possibly be available for appointments. And then you also explicitly say, regardless of my availability, these are the only days and times that I want you to book me. Then you get this little link, calendly.com/your username. And then from there, people can just schedule times into your Google Calendar, and it adjusts for time zone, and they see your availabilities. And I can't tell you how many hours this has saved me with clients, because like we'll have that email that's like, great, let's have a video call. And then there's that dance of like, how about these times? How about these times? Oh, I'm only there, but at 2:00. No, I just say, great, let's meet. Click here to schedule. They click it. They don't have to sign up. There's no bullshit. It's very minimal interface. Like it doesn't spam them ever. There's no garbage. They just see my upcoming availability for the next 10 days and they can just pick a slot. It automatically confirms it. It reminds them before it happens. It's super awesome. It even does stuff like it'll send the little Google Meet link to them. So like it has the video call link in the email. It has saved me so much time and effort and back and forth. So I even think like this would be super helpful for a small startup or a company to like use it internally to like know when you guys are available instead of like pinging back and forth constantly. It's like, I've used it unfortunately a couple times with friends even like, hey, I want to hang out. I want to grab lunch. I'm like, hey, here's when I'm available. Cause like it's silly, but at the same time, like when we're both busy, it's tough to find that overlap sometimes. So it's like, there it is, man. Just like, let's do it, you know? But it's an awesome service and it's been great. And I've been on the free tier for a long time and it's been fine. And I'm sure there's a lot of value in the pro tier, but I haven't yet needed to go there. So it's been good.
Totally. I have to say, I've been on the receiving end of a Calendly link. I got to say the interface is like perfect, because it's like, you just pick the slot that you want to be in, and like, bingo, bango, it sends like the Google Calendar thing. And it's like in your calendar now, it's in their calendar. It's like, that was perfect. I love it.
Yeah. It's super slick. Well, guys, we will see you next week. Thanks so much for listening. If you could take a second to support us and just leave a quick review in whatever method you're listening to this, so whatever that is, if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, feel free to visit our website, iterationpodcast.com. If you scroll to the bottom, you'll see me and JP's Twitter handles. That's the best way to reach out to us. I think there's an email link there too, but thanks for listening, guys.
All right, we'll talk to you guys next time.